This episode is brought to you in part by the Table Podcast from the Hendricks Center at Dallas Theological Seminary. I'm Daryl Bach, one of the hosts, and I invite you to join us as we discuss issues of God and culture, which includes anything and everything. Listen on your podcast app or at dts.edu/thetable.
This episode is brought to you in part by Richmond Graduate University. The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly. Richmond Graduate University can equip you to become a licensed professional counselor, integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmond.edu.
Hello, this is Russell Moore. You're listening to The Russell Moore Show, brought to you by the Public Theology Project at Christianity Today. Every week here, we explore conversations and questions from a Christian perspective. And today, I want to talk about happiness, because there's a new book out that I read. And, you know, there are so many books that purport to deal with happiness. This one was really, really helpful, called From Strength to Strength by my guest, Arthur Brooks. And I really wasn't surprised, because I've been reading Arthur Brooks for years, and especially the past couple years is How to Build a Life column through the Atlantic. If you haven't seen that, it deals with many of the issues that we're talking about today, and you'll want to look at it. He is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School and Business School, teaching the next generation some of the things that we'll be talking about today. Arthur Brooks, thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Russell. It's great to be with you. I haven't talked to you in some months, maybe a couple of years, as a matter of fact.
Well, we were out on the West Coast together in Pacific.
That's true. We were in Vancouver, Washington together some months ago. That's true,
actually. You know, before we get into these issues of happiness that I want to talk about, a couple things that are sort of in the news right now that I think are kind of related, that I'm curious. With the horror of the Uvalde shooting, the Buffalo shooting, all of the things that we've seen, one of the things that has come up several times is a sort of mental health crisis happening, especially among young people, some say. And there are others who will say, no, this is the same sort of depravity that we've always seen. It's not anything new. But others are saying, you know, look at the stresses and the strains after COVID, and study after study showing that there really are some significant mental health concerns happening now with younger people. What's your view on that?
So I look at the data as a social scientist, and, you know, I care about it in the same way that anybody does who is a father of a young adult children, too, of course, because my kids are in their 20s, in their early 20s. But as a social scientist, it's hard to deny the fact that there is a real crisis, a real mental health crisis. It's really an unhappiness crisis. And you might even take it a little bit deeper and say that what we see is a real lack of love for people in their early 20s. And, you know, it's interesting because as a social scientist, but also as a Christian, there's an easy way to understand it, not to solve it, but an easy way to understand it, which is, you know, the first letter of St. John, in which John the Apostle says that perfect love drives out fear. It is an absolute truth, philosophically, psychologically, even neuroscientifically, that love and fear are opposites. That hatred and love are not opposites. Hatred is downstream from fear. When you see a lot of fear that's creating trouble in a society, that means there's a lack of love. And you absolutely see that for people who are in their early 20s and mid-20s today. You find that they are about 30 percentage points less likely to be married. And again, people listening to us, we have a lot of people who are in their 20s today. They'll object and say, yeah, but what about cohabitation? That's down too. You find that even the likelihood of saying I am in love is down 30 percentage points compared to what it was when you and I fell in love with our wives in the 1980s. And that's catastrophic. And so that lack of love, it's counterbalance is fear. And that fear is creating a tremendous amount of unhappiness, a tremendous amount of anxiety, depression, and a lot of the things that we see. I don't know if the shootings that we've seen, these atrocities, are related to that. I suspect that they're not. I suspect that those are really deep mental health, schizophrenic and psychotic problems, untreated mental health problems that are the same kind of problems that we would see in the same frequency as before. But there are a lot of people who are not even near some sort of a crime, not even near even some sort of self-harm, but who are suffering a great deal more than they would have 30 and 40 years ago.
Given the fact that this is unique, how often this is happening in our country, do you think there's anything in terms of public policy that can be done in terms of gun access, gun culture, and so forth? Or will that, in your view, not address the problem?
I don't know is the answer to that, because as a public policy analyst, I'm somebody who suffered through a PhD in public policy analysis, and so I chronically say, I don't know. I mean, the more educated you get in public policy, the more likely you are to not be able to answer these questions. And the truth is that you look at the amount of gun violence, the likelihood of being harmed by gun violence, and adjusted for population, is very similar to the United States as it is in many Western European countries that have way stronger gun laws than we have in the United States. Now, that doesn't mean that better gun laws and gun safety, that couldn't do anything good for us. Perhaps there are ways that we could craft our laws, or with background checks, or with appropriate mental health interventions that are identified when people are trying to get guns, or whatever we're trying to do, that people should be able to agree on, and right and left. The problem that we have with our gun laws is that we're just such absolutists in so many areas where the vast majority of Americans, they agree that we should be able to do more, and we should have some common sense reforms. And this is not just about conservatives and guns, by the way. The same exact kind of argumentation goes with respect to abortion, where, the vast overwhelming majority of Americans think that some common sense restrictions on abortion, and yet the whole thing is taken hostage by people who have extremely hardcore polarized views on the subject. So it's nothing weird that we would actually see the whole debate becoming impossible to adjudicate from and make improvements from a very mainstream standpoint. So the young people who are listening to us and people who are not so young listening to us who say, why can't we make any progress? The basic answer is that people who don't have mainstream views are yelling the loudest and controlling the conversation.
Something that is not nearly as important as this, but is a focus right now, student debt. Conversations about forgiving student debt. And one of the things that's really unique about you is you're one of the few Harvard professors, public intellectuals, who will say, we ought to be thinking about college differently. And not everybody needs to do it the traditional way. What do you think for somebody who's thinking through, should I take on a bunch of debt and get a college degree, or should I do something else? What would your counsel be to them?
Well, it depends on the person, to be sure, and the kind of ambitions that they have for their own career. But the one thing that doesn't make sense at all is that they got a tremendous amount of debt to go to a liberal arts college. That just doesn't make sense. And the reason for that is that there's so much high quality education that's absolutely affordable. I raised my kids in Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C. I live in Boston now, but when my kids were growing up, and I would talk to a lot of parents who would say, oh my goodness, Haverford College is so unbelievably expensive. My son wants to go to Haverford College. I said, no. The thing to do, if you don't have very many resources but you want higher education, is to start off at community college and transfer to the University of Maryland, which is an absolutely outstanding institution. That's the right thing to do, because it's $3,000 a year for the community college and $9,000 a year in-state for the state university. There's tons of high-quality alternatives, and this idea that somehow people have to take on huge amounts of debt. The real debt problem that we have in this country, by the way, is people who don't finish college and don't have, nobody says you get credit for half your sophomore year. You'll only get credit, you know, only get credit for going to college in the job market when you go through all 4 years. And that's actually the kind of reform that we need. You know, the more college that you do, it should be like a thermometer. It goes up. It's a continuous thing. It's not a discrete measure of zero or one, or one is the entire college degree. You should be able to get more school, and the more school that you get should be appropriate to the kind of job that you're doing, and that we should have way more alternatives from state schools, community colleges, trade schools, vocational schools, and we should match people to the cost-effective alternative with the amount of education that's best for their hopes and dreams.
Well, your book is called From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life.
Right.
But it's a little bit misleading because this really is for people in the first or second halves of life.
For sure.
And as I was reading this, I was thinking, there is so much here that I wish I had read when I was 22. It would have helped me a lot. But before we talk about some of those things, there's a saying sort of in my corner of the evangelical Christian world that's often given, God cares about your holiness, not your happiness. And sometimes there's this assumption that happiness is kind of a modern self-expression, self-actualization sort of idea that really isn't what we should be concerned about. I think you see that differently. How so?
Well, part of it has to do with what happiness means. You know, everybody thinks they know what it is until they start thinking about it. It's like, huh, it's a head scratcher. I asked my students on the first day of class, I teach this graduate class seminar on happiness for the Harvard Business School. And, you know, these are some of the most talented students I've ever met. And they spend all of their elective points to get into the happiness class. So say, you guys must know what it is or you wouldn't have actually invested in it like this. What is it? And I cold call them. And one by one, they talk about their feelings. And I say, wrong. If that's the case, then God does care about your holiness, not your happiness, because the whole idea of feelings, as you know, C.S. Lewis used to say that, you know, how you feel about things depends on what you're digesting as much as anything else. And, you know, God should not be so shallow as to be all in the business of our feelings, for Pete's sake. Our holiness is much deeper than that. But real happiness is not feelings any more than your Thanksgiving dinner is nothing more than the smell of the turkey. Your happy feelings are evidence of happiness, and happiness as a neuroscientific and social scientific matter is a combination of the enjoyment that you have in your life, the satisfaction that you have in your accomplishments and the rewards for the job well done that you do, and the meaning and purpose of your life, which requires a lot of suffering. And so this is the key thing to keep in mind, that happiness from a beatific perspective, from a Christian perspective, requires a lot of unhappiness. It requires a lot of holiness. It requires a lot of suffering. I mean, look, we're the only religion in the world that understands that we're a religion based on suffering. That we understand that suffering is an incredibly sacred thing. I mean, our Lord suffered. And that was part of the essence of his holiness. The master of the universe suffered in a very human way. And we should try to avoid suffering. My goodness, what a irreverent thought for us. And once we get into the I'm trying to not suffer and trying to feel better and I'm trying to be happy, then of course happiness is orthogonal to holiness in this case, but not when we properly understand happiness.
And isn't it true that a sort of manufactured artificial happiness actually contributes to the problem? I think all the time about a woman I knew who had a miscarriage and was grieving, and she didn't want to go to her church. And I said, why not? And she said, well, because everything there is so happy. All the songs are about happiness and joy. There's not this sense of lament that takes place in my church. And it actually contributed to her unhappiness. It wasn't able to lead her to a happier place because it didn't. I mean, the Book of Psalms has joy, lament, anger. I mean, the full range of human emotion.
There's a book called Lamentations. I mean, for Pete's sake. I mean, the whole. I mean, read Ecclesiastes, and you know, tell me that you know, it's the Bible is full of suffering, because human life is full of suffering, and to take that out is kind of like Thomas Jefferson snipping out all the parts of the Bible he didn't like to make make Jefferson's Bible, aka not the Bible. You know, the Christian religion without suffering is simply not the Christian religion. You know, we're called to live, to be fully alive. You know, this is St. Irenaeus, and I'm a Catholic, so I make these saint references, but this is in the fourth century, so this is pre-Protestantism. This is the patrimony of all Christian people. St. Irenaeus said that the glory of God is a man fully alive, by which he meant a person fully alive. And to be fully alive is to have all of the sensations, all of the emotions, to be walking through the world with all the good and the bad that it is, because this is God's gift to us. It's weird, you know, that only when you, and this is as a social scientific matter you find this, but it's just the experience that we all have. When you finally confront life in all of its complexities, then the fullness of life can actually become a source of this deep satisfaction to you in the first place. But if you're spending all of your time or a lot of your time and your energy trying to avoid unhappiness, you will paradoxically avoid your happiness by cutting the meaning, by cutting the purpose out of your life, by cutting a good deal of sacredness out of your life in the first place. You got to live it all, man.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned these declining rates of love, experience of being in love. That's exactly at the root of at least a lot of what I encounter.
Yeah.
Are people who will say, in order to pursue someone or to commit to someone, I have to know that there's no risk there, that this person is going to be my soulmate. And that's not how it works.
That's not how it works. You know, fear of rejection is something that I think that, interesting, my friend and colleague Jonathan Haidt, who's a great social psychologist, teaches at the Stern School of Business at New York University. And he does all this work that shows that young people are more fearful of social rejection than any other generation since we've been keeping records. And a lot of it has to do with social media, which puts everybody on display. It raises the stakes to everything, raises the stakes to your mistakes, et cetera, cancel culture, et cetera, et cetera. But he also says that it has to do with the way that we, people you're and my age, raise our young adult children and have done so to with the safetyism cult that keeps them, you know, adjudicating their disputes when they're in elementary school. I mean, when you and I would get into a fight on the playground, you know, you'd go home and, you know, I got beat up and my dad would be like, so did you deserve it? You know, I used to run around basically unsupervised. And I get it. I get it. I mean, I grew up in a working class neighborhood in Seattle, the same neighborhood that Ted Bundy had been marauding through. And my parents are like, yeah, it's okay if you have a 4:30 a.m. paper route by yourself. And by the way, don't come back till dinner. I mean, it was maybe that's too much. But let me tell you. When you protect kids from the pathogens of conflict, of rejection, of hurt, they will not be ready for these things in their 20s. And, you know, to young people listening to us, you got to get exposed to things. You got to get your chops up. You have to have resiliency. And if you don't, it's just going to be much, much harder to form the relationships that are at the basis of a good and happy life.
Well, what would you say to someone who's listening to this who says, you know, I'm in my 20s and I do have this sort of inordinate fear of rejection, but what do I do about it? I can't go back and retroactively change my upbringing or my circumstances. So what do I do if I'm just constantly worried about what people think of me?
Yeah, so the thing to do, I actually write about that a lot in my column in The Atlantic, and that's my next book is actually going to be about, you know, the things, how to start out right as a young adult, and by the way, how we all can start over right at any age in life. Because just as, you know, the second half of life is actually the first half of life, vice versa is true as well. The first thing that young people are very comfortable with that can be quite helpful is the metaphor of entrepreneurship. You know, all young people learn about startups and taking risk and starting businesses and all that, ways that guys like you and me didn't come naturally to us because we didn't talk about that when we were in our 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. But they're very comfortable with in their 20s and 30s today. Now, one of the things to keep in mind is that failure is part of startup life. Now, entrepreneurship really isn't about business creation. Entrepreneurship is about creating explosive rewards. It's about faith in resources that you don't currently have in hand. It's about a vision of a better future along some lines. Starting a business is the most boring kind of entrepreneurship. And I don't think it's bad, I think it's great. I love living in a capitalist entrepreneurial society. The most common type of entrepreneurship is the startup of your life with a currency of your love and your heart. That's the most entrepreneurial thing that most people do. Falling in love is the biggest startup enterprise that anybody can engage in. Now, when you look at the data on startup businesses, the average successful startup entrepreneur has 3.8 failures before their first success. Mm. Let's just think about that and put it in perspective. When you're gonna, if you're gonna have a happy, successful entrepreneurial life that has a lot of love in it, you need at least 3.8 nasty breakups. You know, you need somebody to stomp on your heart a bunch of times because you're simply not going to learn. Treat it like a startup. You know, I've done this before. I was talking to a bunch of young people in Washington, D.C., and I said, treat your love like a startup. And a couple weeks later, I run into this kid on a plane. He's not a kid. He's in his 20s on a plane. And he says, he identifies me. Are you Dr. Brooks? I said, yeah. He said, I couldn't get that thing you said out of my head to treat my love like a startup. And so I'm on my way to tell this woman that I've been secretly in love with for 2 years that I'm in love with her and ask her to be with me. And I said, I'm like, it's only a speech, man. Because, you know, I don't want to ruin his life. I found him a couple of months later and I ran into him again. I said, how did it work out? He said, she rejected me. I said, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to lead you astray. He says, no, you don't understand. That was the thing I was most afraid of. And the worst thing happened and I didn't die. And I'm not going to be afraid anymore. He faced the pathogen. See, a lot of young people have kind of a social peanut allergy. And that is actually a thing that didn't exist when we were kids because people were exposed to the pathogen. Now, peanut allergy is a real deal. I'm not saying you should go eat peanuts if you have a peanut allergy. Right. But if you're afraid of love, you actually need more. You need to face fear more. And the only way to face fear more is to recognize that you're not afraid of the outcome. This is a psychological truth. You're not afraid of actually what will happen if you're rejected. You're afraid of your own feelings. That's what's happening. Almost all fear of rejection is the fear of my own feelings about myself. When you recognize the absurdity of that, then you're a lot less likely to fail. The second thing is to start visualizing the failure itself to make it more familiar. That's exposure therapy. There's a lot of Buddhist meditation about death, for example. And the reason is that only when you're comfortable with your death, which as Christians, we're completely comfortable with our deaths. You know, it's like, I go to heaven, man. I couldn't be more comfortable with anything, actually. We're just, you know, the key thing is you got to hold it back. So you're not supposed to say, bring it on, right? Yeah. But the Buddhists, you know, that have a lot more earthbound understanding of that, they have to expose themselves to the concept of death. And that's what I recommend that young people do as well, is to meditate on envisioning the very thing that you're afraid of, and it will become familiar. You'll be less afraid. So these are the kinds of ways that I counsel young people, and it can be like a miracle. It can be really life-changing when they get past this.
So the idea, think positively, think about all of the, give affirmations to yourself about how this, I am going, this is going to succeed.
Yeah, no.
That's not the way to go.
No. That's not the way to do it. No. It's like, no, negative affirmation. Bring it on. Be tough. You know, face your fears is what it comes down to. So number one, be an entrepreneur, which says, I believe that explosive, incredible riches are possible. But I also recognize that failure is a real possibility and it's going to happen more than success. But I need enough deal flow to get the success. And then work your way through the scenario of actual failure. So that's step one and step two.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. I know when we have a really busy week, when we have so many great things to do, but there's something on the calendar every day, my social battery can get totally depleted. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and to spread ourselves thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. And what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Figuring out what we need on our own can be challenging. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to understand your needs and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's convenient, flexible, and easily fits into your social calendar. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/RussellMoore today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/RussellMoore.
Hmm. You know, one of the things that I've noticed over the past several years, a lot of people in Christian ministry, evangelical Christian ministry, maybe especially sort of our ecclesial equivalent of entrepreneurs, church planters and people who have started new ministries. I've seen them in their 40s, many of them just sort of come apart in different ways. I mean, sometimes it's affairs, sometimes it's alcoholism, sometimes it's something else, that coming apart. And I've always thought of that more in terms of kind of the feeling of mortality. But when I was reading your book, I mean, one of the things you talk about is the difference between that that fluid intelligence, as you call it, in the first half of life, changing over to a crystallized intelligence, and that throws some people sometimes. Explain to us what that's about.
Yeah, so this is a really important thing for people in Christian ministry, but also who in surgery and in lawyer life and in, you know, be financial planners and accountants and everybody else in between. And the way that it works is that really highly motivated, striving people get incredibly good at what they're doing in their 20s and 30s on the basis of what psychologists call fluid intelligence. That's innovative capacity. That's crystallized. That's working memory. That's incredible creativity. That's indefatigable energy and focus. That's, you know, church planning is all about that. You're going to put a church out there someplace, you need to be very innovative. You need to be incredibly energetic. You have to, you know, never slow down. And what you'll find is that the more you do it, the better you get. And you can be incredibly effective. The problem is that ability peaks in the late 30s or early 40s, and then it starts to decline. And it starts to get just harder to get the energy to do what you used to do relatively easily. That's called burnout. And one of the things is that extremely effective strivers, they're the first to notice. What used to be easy is hard. What used to be, you know, simple to motivate myself to do, now I can barely get out of bed to do it. That's because your fluid intelligence is in decline, and then you're going to start to turn to alcohol. You might have an affair. Maybe you're just a really good dentist, and you start taking Fridays off. Maybe it's something like that. But it's like, why would you take Fridays off when you used to love your job so much? Why would you want to take a day off to do something that's trivial, like golf, compared to what was your vocation, your holy vocation of healing people and giving them better teeth? And so that's really what's going on that. And the thing to keep in mind is that it does decline, but there's the best news. God's great gift to us is the second intelligence curve. That's a different set of skills that comes, everybody gets it in their 40s and 50s, and it can stay high in your 60s and 70s and 80s, and as long as God gives you years. It's called crystallized intelligence, which is your wisdom curve, your teaching curve, your team building curve, your mentorship curve. This is your ability to speak fluently, to put ideas together that other people's created, and to teach people things that you haven't been able to do before. So what I recommend to people who are in clergy, so I deal with Catholic priests more than I deal with evangelical ministers, but the evangelical crowd I talk to a lot these days too. And what I recommend for church planters, for example, is to make sure that you have a plan in the churches that you're planting to be able to step into a more senior teaching role by the time you're in your early 50s. And you have other people that are running the operation behind you that have this indefatigable energy that can grow the business. Sorry, I don't mean to use the language of business, but like the grow the organization. These are nonprofit organizations, can grow it in innovative and new ways while you're stepping back into a senior pastor role to teach new people and where you don't have to work 80 hours a week too. That's a super important thing to plan out. That's basically just a happiness 401k plan.
Hmm. You know, when we look at American political life, the president's about to turn 80.
Yeah.
The prospective Republican nominee is in the late 70s. The Speaker of the House is 81, I think. You just go through, the Senate Majority Leader is in his 80s. Is that a healthy thing? I mean, is it people sort of, is it that we're recognizing the sage-like wisdom of age? Or is it instead the reverse, that you have a generation of people who are not really wanting to let go and turn things over to a younger generation?
Yeah. So that it's the latter. And, you know, again, I want Ross Lawless to crystallize intelligence. Most Americans don't really want to vote for a presidential candidate who's under 50. And there's a reason. There's a sense of wisdom that comes from people who are over 50 because crystallized intelligence tends to be really high. This idea of working together, of explaining things, of pattern recognition, of just deep wisdom. We understand that people have that, but then there's an energy level problem that you get when you're too old. For most people, mm-hmm. there's this curve in there. This when the curves cross of these different things, you can be very, very wise, but there's almost nobody that can live up to the energy needs of the presidency of the United States after 70 or 75 years old. It's just too hard a job to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, why do we keep electing people? Because the party system locks people out, except for seniority reasons. You know, you basically have it's like the old Soviet Union. It's like the Politburo, which is just a bunch mm-hmm. of old men. We used to remember, Russell, when you and I were kids in the 70s, we would laugh at the gerontocracy of these, you know, one old right. man that would take over after another and immediately die. And they would go yeah. out of public view, and the joke would be they got a really bad haircut. And the truth was because they were ailing and dying and becoming senile and the whole thing. And now the United States is rewarding these political leaders that really are a little bit too old to be doing what they're doing. And so what do we need? We need kind of a sweet spot, you know, for leaders in a capitalist democracy that we choose. We should be looking at people who are probably more between, you know, the ages of 50 and 70. That's kind of the sweet zone of you know, lots of crystallized intelligence, but also if you've got good health, a lot of energy as well.
But that requires also, though, younger people who are actually wanting to take the responsibilities of, in this case, governing. I mean, if you look, it doesn't matter what party or what place on the ideological spectrum. A lot of the people who are in that fluid intelligence stage are just sort of wanting to be on cable news and raise money. I mean, there are some yeah. exceptions to that, but that's what's really being rewarded right now.
Yeah, that's true. And so what we need is people who, if they have a real ambition to serve in their 50s and 60s, they need to be cultivating their leadership abilities in their 20s and 30s, quite frankly. And that mm-hmm. means different kinds of offices and different kinds of leadership, whether in business or nonprofits or even politics, really when they're on their fluid intelligence curve and as they're growing older, such that they're ready and they have enough perspective and they have enough experience to be at these high, high, high level positions, whether it's the CEO of IBM or the President of the United States, when they're in especially the especially good age to be doing that. But you gotta be doing a lot at 40 to be the president at 55. mm-hmm. And you can't yeah. just kind of show up and say, well, I'm old enough now. And I had a lot yeah. of fun, and I had a cable show. I mean, that's just kind of not good enough.
Sometimes that happens, but
it can happen. But I'm not saying I don't think it's ideal most of the time.
Right? No, that's for sure. I smiled in your book when I saw the name Wayne Oates, who's a professor at my alma mater, who was a professor at my alma mater. He coined the term workaholic. Yeah. That was in his obituary in the New York Times. They coined that term. And you talk about this success addiction. And as I was reading that, I was wondering, how does one know if one is sort of addicted to success or if one is just ambitious, just wants to accomplish a lot?
Success addiction is like any other addiction. All addictions have the same neurobiological roots. What's implicated is a neuromodulator called dopamine. Almost everybody knows about it. For a long time, it was called the pleasure neurotransmitter, but it's not. It's the neurotransmitter of anticipation of a reward. So, for example, whether you're just, it's like, I really, really, really want to go play the slot machines, or I really, really want a cigarette, or, man, I'm just craving a drink, or, you know, whatever it happens to be, or, you know, and by the way, one of the worst addictions that a lot of Christian people suffer from is pornography addiction. It's a dangerous, mm-hmm. dangerous thing because it just wires your brain. So the dopamine makes you extremely productive at processing pornography with tremendous damage to relationships, just like any other addiction, to be sure, but that's just a really nasty one that's very prominent in the Christian community. And they all work dopamine the same way, as does the success addiction. Now, success addiction usually starts with people who are strivers early in life. They're good students, or they're really hard workers, or they're identified as kind of the special one, often by their parents. Look, despite our parents and our best intentions, we objectify our kids. we project our own autobiography onto the screen of our children. You know, my kids, I'm so proud of them. You know, one of them went to Princeton, and the other didn't go to college, and he's a sniper in the U.S. Marine Corps. And my little girl, she's in college in Spain. She's getting straight A's. And what am I doing when I'm bragging to you right now, Russell? I want to be a tough guy in the Special Forces. I want to go to Princeton. I want to go study in Spain. I'm projecting my autobiography onto the screen of my children because I'm so proud of them, but I'm really thinking about me. And that's what we do all the time. And the problem with that is that we objectify our kids into becoming the special one, and they objectify themselves. So the high-achieving kids often turn into people who have impossibly high standards for themselves, and where they only really get satisfaction in life when they're succeeding in school, succeeding at work, succeeding in sports, succeeding in the arts, succeeding in everything that they do. And that's what gives them this dopamine hit. You know, hit the lever, get the cookie. No satisfaction after about a day, and then it's back at it. You're on the treadmill again and again and again. And when that's reinforced all the way through young adulthood, by the time that, you know, then this flywheel is going with terrifying speed at 30s and 40s, and you literally can't understand yourself as anything less than a successful person. That goes way beyond healthy ambition. That's an incredibly unhealthy state. It's like being a methamphetamine addict. As a matter of fact, your brain kind of looks like a methamphetamine addict's. And you got to treat it the same way as any other addiction. You need to confront it. You need to offer it up to our Lord. You need to make amends to the people that you hurt, because a success addict always hurts tons of people along the way, usually with desiccated relationships and bad marriages and ignoring their kids. And then you actually have to work through it the same way.
What about somebody, and I've heard from many people who have had this experience lately, where they've realized, wait a minute, that's exactly what I've been doing, and my relationships have suffered. What do I do now? I mean, they're looking around and they say, I don't even have connections to the people that I love anymore.
Right.
How do I rekindle that?
Yeah, to begin with, you actually have to do what you would do if you went to Alcoholics Anonymous and you went through any 12-step program. You have to admit that you were powerless over this. And again, nobody's completely powerless. You wouldn't be an AA if you were powerless, you know?
Right.
But then you have to offer up. Look, almost everybody, not everybody, but almost everybody listening to us or Christian sisters and brothers with us, and they recognize that you can't do anything meaningful. You can't do anything worthwhile without offering it up to the Lord. So offer it up to the Lord. That's the second part. And then the third basic part of this is to start reestablishing relationships, understanding that not everybody's going to accept it, saying, you know, I'm sorry I skipped all your little league games and ballet recitals because of meaningless meetings to further my own career. It's because of my brain chemistry. Not everybody's going to say, okay, Dad, all good. You know, it's, sorry, honey, I haven't paid attention to you for these last 15 years and you're really, really lonely and you kind of hate me. But, you know, how about bringing me back? At least throw yourself in the mercy of the people who love you or that you love, and then recognize this is going to take some time, if it can happen at all, to make it. But it's not going to happen if you don't start, is my bottom line. And that's the same thing with any addiction.
Ashley here. If you're looking for another podcast that features inspiring conversations with religious leaders, authors, and artists, then I recommend listening to the acclaimed podcast, No Small Endeavor. Produced by Great Feelings Studios and PRX, No Small Endeavor explores what it means to live a good life. Each episode, host Lee C. Camp sits down with special guests, like award-winning journalist and best-selling author Tim Alberta and civil rights hero Reverend James Lawson, to ask what it means to live a life worth living. You can even hear from Russell Moore on No Small Endeavor. If you're looking for somewhere to start, check out their new episode with Malcolm Gladwell, New York Times best-selling author and host of the wildly popular podcast Revisionist History. They explore how Malcolm became a stellar storyteller, some of the things he may or may not regret, and so much more. Don't miss out. Follow No Small Endeavor wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it's similar to you write in the book about loneliness quite a bit. And this is just the mail that I get listeners and readers about loneliness. And one of the big questions that people have is to say, okay, I'm lonely. But what can I do without this kind of awkwardness? I mean, you can't, like you're in kindergarten, I like you, do you like me, will you be my friend? You know, so people are saying, how do I establish friendships? How do I initiate that? Or younger people who say, I really want a mentor, but how do you just go ask somebody to be a mentor without that just being really weird and awkward?
I know. Well, but to begin with, a lot of people who have these fears, they don't actually realize how much infrastructure there is out there for friendship, for real friendship, for good, useless friendships, as opposed to the useful friendships that they're used to. So this is real friends versus deal friends. People who have only deal friends, they don't recognize that there's actually a world out there built for creating real friendships.
And what's a deal friendship?
Oh, a deal friendship is somebody that actually can further your career. That's a deal friendship, somebody who's good for you. And then again, I have deal friends, and I like my deal friends. But the point is, I have real friends, too. I got this, one of my closest friends is a guy named Frank Hanna that you may know in Atlanta, who is, you know, I talked to him today. And what do we talk about? We talk about our families, we talk about our children, we talk about our faith all the time, because it's really important that we keep each other close to our own walk, because, you know, his heart is my heart when it comes to, this is what, you know, the Christian brotherhood is really all about. And how do we meet? We met at a work thing, you know, like 20 years ago. We met at a thing and we just hit it off because we were both Christian men. And you know, the thing about it is that there were a bunch of things that we did together professionally as a pretext to actually start hanging out. You know, if you want to mentor other people to create a more of a connection to other people, there's lots of organizations that can facilitate that. If you want to meet other guys or other gals that you just want to make friends with, if you're a Catholic, join the Knights of Columbus, man. You're not going to be doing deals. You're going to be shooting pool and drinking beer, is what it comes down to, and talking about our Lord and Savior at the same time. It's all the good stuff. Right? and so it's just the people who are just wrapped up in work all the time and who are success addicts, they just don't even know that these opportunities exist. You just got to do a little shoe leather can help a lot.
You know, you talk in the book about idolatry, you quote David Foster Wallace in his powerful This Is Water speech about idols and about worshiping things. How do you discern because all of these things that you mention as idols, they're almost never graven images. I mean, and they're things that are good when they're in their right order. But how can you tell when something's out of priority, whether it's a job or a marriage or a friendship or whatever it is?
Yeah, the key thing is, what would you give up for it is really the acid test. Now, again, you're right. It's not like we're praying to Baal, you know, all that good biblical stuff. There's a golden calf in my living room. It's like, I go to church on Sundays, but the golden calf, I really pray to that golden calf. Of course not. That's absurd. Nobody's doing that. But what do we pray to? The almighty dollar. What do we pray to? Our number of followers on social media. Why? Because those are the things that actually have our heart. So start thinking about, what would you give up? What are the things that you would actually give up? It's interesting. You know, I'll ask my friends this, some people really do have this idolatry of money, power, pleasure, fame. These are, by the way, those are the idols that St. Thomas Aquinas in 1265 listed as the four substitutes for God, the quintessential idols of human life, is money, power, pleasure, and fame. And fame, honor, prestige, admiration. It doesn't mean you want to be Kim Kardashian. It just means that you hunger after the admiration of other people. Social comparison is a really, really big deal to you. Other people who actually have their values even more in line, they have a little bit of idolatry too. You know, how many Christian people that we know follow the cult of workism? You know, where their work is everything. My work is my life. My work is my identity. Now let's make it a little hotter. How many follow the cult of familyism? You know, where it's like you say, really? I mean, if it went, you're not going to have to choose between your faith and your family. But if you did, what would it be? And people basically say, my family is everything to me. My family is the most important thing to me. I hear Christian people saying this all the time. And I'm like, for Pete's sake, that's a cult, man. Yeah. I mean, it's not. And you're not supposed to worship anything before the Lord. anything before the Lord, including your family. And I get it. You know, some people will be listening to this going, I don't believe it. You know, there's got to be some way to square the circle. But it's the same thing that people have always said. There's some way that I can be, you know, I can still love the money, but still be a good Christian. No. St. Paul said it very clearly in his letter to Timothy, for the love of money, for that is the root of all evil. He didn't say money is the root of all evil. He said the love of money is the root of all evil. And that is basically not to say that there's something wrong with money, but being idolatrous with the money is putting the money in front of God, because, you know, love is dedicated to people and to the Lord, and that's it.
You know, that issue of comparison, that's a huge one. I mean, there are many people I know whose lives are just miserable because they're looking around and saying, well, why can't I have what she has? Or right. Why can't I? Or vice versa, whose lives are kind of stagnant because they're saying, well, at least I'm better off than so-and-so.
For sure. But a lot of it comes in, and even in our Christian communities, to say, you know, why can't I have a wife as good as that person's wife? Or why can't I have a husband as handsome and successful as that person's husband? So even, you know, that kind of comparison is just as deleterious and winds up being just as idolatrous as somebody who says, you know, I feel crummy about myself because my boat isn't as big as my neighbor's.
One last word. What would you say to people, because I hear from a lot of them, who are either pastors or Sunday school teachers or leaders of some kind, maybe lay leaders in their local congregation? A lot of them say, when I look out at the Facebook feeds of the people that I lead or that I serve, I start to say, what have I even been doing? And they feel like failures because they see so much anger and rancor and so forth. How would you advise someone to lead other people toward a happier life?
Now, part of the problem is that with social media is not that it's creating more awfulness, but that the awfulness is more apparent. You can actually see it in ways that you wouldn't be able to. So, you know, when you and I were kids and we would be talking to, if I'm talking to the priest and the priest asks me about, you know, my attitudes about this, that, or the other thing, I'm going to give him the right answer. But if he were actually able to read my Twitter feed, if one had existed, it's a different matter. So I think it's important not to be discouraged. Look, I mean, there's nothing new under the sun, Russell. We don't have to, like, sin is sin and people are people. Now, social media might bring out the worst in us, but it's not as if these terrible feelings are brand new and everything in the halcyon days of the 1970s. Remember the 70s? It was pretty grim, actually. There's a lot of political polarization and hatred and the Iran-Contra affair and, you know, Watergate and it was awful in a lot of ways and awful in, you know, just humanity is what it is. So I recommend that pastors and all of us, by the way, who have a moral responsibility but also an incredible opportunity to help young people along their path. Because only in helping young people along their path are we helping ourselves along our own path, too. If you're in your crystallized intelligence curve, man, it's all about sharing and mentoring and teaching. That's how you get to heaven, too. And the key thing is to recognize that all of these things are incredible opportunities. Look, I believe that we are at the cusp of a new enlightenment, of a new day for Christian evangelization. Because, you know, the thing about it is that this has always happened. When there was dark days and that led to a hunger, I think there's going to be a rebellion against the culture of bitterness, the culture of contempt, which is the conviction of the worthlessness of other people. You know, I look at when the influencers, the cultural influencers on the progressive left and on the populist right. Mm-hmm. So you basically, the populist right and the cultural left, which are very similar in lots of ways. And what are they doing? The people our age, they're conscripting young people as child soldiers in their culture war. Mm-hmm. That's what people our age are doing, saying you must hate, you must be afraid, and you must use your values as a weapon and not as a gift. And young people, young people who are listening to us need to rebel. It's time for rebellion. And that's a rebellion of love. That rebellion of love, and then it can, it's a Gen Z people are going to, they're going to save America, I actually think. They're going to save America from us by rebelling against the culture war in which they're expected to be soldiers and to say, we refuse to hate. We demand love. You know, you need the, You know, and what people, I think what pastors and, you know, leaders, you and me, quite frankly, need to do is to cultivate that rebellion, to cultivate that reconquista of our culture. And once we start getting that, there's no holding it back. And all these, you know, pathetic voices, our age and older, that are talking about the polarization in this country that's necessary because the other side is stupid and evil, lying that the biggest threat to our country is your next door neighbor who votes for the other party, that they're going to get tossed out like yesterday's news, and it can't happen too soon. So kids, bring it on and save America. From
us. That's a good word. The book is called From Strength to Strength. Arthur Brooks, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Russell. God bless you, and God bless all of our listeners.
And thanks to you listeners for listening. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and leave a review. It'll help people to find the show. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap the cover art and you'll find the show notes along with how you can get a copy of this book and some other resources such as the How to Build a Life column that Arthur Brooks writes at The Atlantic. And while you're there, check out Christianity Today. You can have a free trial membership and to join us here at CT. This is Russell Moore, and you're listening to the Christianity Today Public Theology Project's Russell Moore Show.
The Russell Moore Show is a production of Christianity Today. Eric Petrick is our Chief Creative Officer. Russell Moore is the Executive Producer and our host. Mike Cosper is our Director of Podcasts. Administration for CT by Christine Kolb, Pam Vodanova, and Abby Perry. Production assistance by Core Media. Beth Grabencourt, Coordinator. Kevin Duthu, Producer and Sound Mixer. Our theme song is Dusty Delta Day by Lennon Hutton. If you like what you heard today, please consider subscribing so you don't miss any future episodes.